Well, good morning, brethren and sisters. So we've seen in previous talks that Nehemiah has been building the wall, but he started to see some quite serious opposition to that work. And in the two chapters before us this morning, that opposition starts to increase. And they start to find that Nehemiah's enemies not just mock him, etc., but they now plan to kill him, just as Christ's enemies later would plan to kill him when he couldn't abolish his teaching. So if you look at verse 1, "Now it came to pass when Sanballat and Tobijah and Geshem the Arabian and the rest of our enemies heard that I builded the wall and that there was no breach left therein, though at that time I had not set up the doors upon the gates." So Nehemiah's got to a really advanced stage in building the wall, etc. He hasn't yet set up all the bars, all the doors, etc. But already at this stage, his enemies can see that they're not able to stop him. Nehemiah's managed to get a coalition of people who want to help him. And so now they want to do him evil, mischief. And as we read through the chapter, they plan to kill him. So how would Nehemiah know that? How does Nehemiah know that they wanted to kill him? Well, Nehemiah, I'm sure, was as harmless as a dove, and yet as wise as a serpent. And he would know what Christ would later teach in Matthew 7, "You shall know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes of thorns or figs of thistles? Even so, every good tree bringeth forth good fruit, for a corrupt tree bringeth forth evil fruit. A good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit, neither can a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit. Every tree that bringeth not forth good fruit is hewn down and cast into the fire. Wherefore by the fruits ye shall know them." And so Nehemiah was using those principles, that rule. He was looking at what his enemies did, not what they said. You know, I'm sure they said the right things. They were nice people, etc. As we'll see later, they got on well with the nobles. Everyone spoke well of them. But Nehemiah wasn't interested in what they said and what people said about them. He was looking at their deeds. Just as later with Christ, Christ watched what the Pharisees did. You know, they plotted to kill him on the Sabbath. They plotted to kill Lazarus after his resurrection to destroy the evidence that Christ had raised from the dead. And yet Christ healed on the Sabbath. So Christ looked at what the Pharisees did and not what they said. So in verse 2 to 3, "Then Sanballat and Geshem sent unto me, saying, Come, let us meet together in some one of the villages in the plain of Ono. But they thought to do me mischief." And so we find later on as well that they plan to meet Nehemiah kind of privately in the temple, make the story up that he kind of was in danger and they're going to protect him, get him into the temple where there was no witnesses, etc. And Nehemiah knew that they were going to try to kill him. But it's interesting here, four times in private and then a fifth time in public, they use threats of using the law, legal means, against Nehemiah. So we start to see a progression over this period of time as to how they plan to tackle Nehemiah. I'll just read you a couple of verses where we see that progression. In Nehemiah chapter 2 it says, "When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobijah the servant, the Ammonite, heard of it, it grieved them exceedingly that there was come a man to seek the welfare of the children of Israel." Then in verse 19, "But when Sanballat and the Horonite and Tobijah the servant, the Ammonite, and Geshem the Arabian heard it, they laughed us to scorn and despised us and said, What is this thing that you do? Will you rebel against the king?" And then in chapter 4, "But it came to pass that when Sanballat heard that we builded the wall, he was wroth and took great indignation and mocked the Jews." Then later, "But it came to pass that when Sanballat and Tobijah and the Arabians and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were made up and that the breaches began to be stopped, then they were very wroth." So we see a progression here. First, people are just grieved, they're upset that Nehemiah, that just one man, had the outrage to come to seek the welfare of the children of Israel. Then they start mocking and they despise the Jews, hoping that would discourage them. And then later it gets worse. They were wroth, they were angry, they had indignation, but they still mocked. And then later they were very wroth. This time they wanted to kill Nehemiah and to use force against him. So we see that progression then. They knew that Nehemiah was never going to be corrupted. He was never going to be bribed, never persuaded against his mission. And his loyalty to God would never sway, no matter what they did to him. And all the way throughout, we see how honest Nehemiah was. his enemies couldn't find any fault in him at all, try as they might. And there's a great lesson in that for us, that we also need to be as wise as serpents and harmless as doves. We should be completely trustworthy in all our dealings, not just with each other, but also with the world. We should have a reputation for being honest at all times, a reputation for being impossible to bribe or corrupt or take shortcuts, etc. Previously, Moses also sought people out as judges who were honest and who he knew could never ever be corrupted. So that's the progression from Nehemiah's enemy side. But just look at the progression from Nehemiah's side. Because first there was just a man, Nehemiah, who's come to seek the welfare of the children of Israel. Just one person. But then they laughed us to scorn. So now Nehemiah had some people with him who also understood what Nehemiah wanted to do to serve God. And then we builded the wall. And the enemies mocked the Jews, you know, lots of people. And then the deed was done and the walls were builded. So Nehemiah started off as one person who would take the stand, a bit like the Alamo, and to fight against the enemies. And then he got other people round him. They laughed us to scorn. And then we builded the wall. So this shows just what one person can do. One man can take a stand. One man can stir others to join the work. One man can inspire an army. One man can stand against all opposition. One man can defeat God's enemies. One man can turn a minority into majority. One man can create an unstoppable force for good and for doing God's will. It was like Gideon previously making a stand against the Baal worshippers, and then others joined him, and eventually there was a whole army fighting God's cause, and then salvation was brought to Israel. So, brothers and sisters, we can be that one individual that makes a stand. We can be the individual who does the right thing, who can't be swayed against God's plans. We don't have to wait until others join us or until there's a majority opinion or anything like that something should be done. We as individuals can be like Nehemiah and get others to join us. But let's take a closer look at who Nehemiah's enemies were in that chapter, because we can learn a lot about them just from their names and their nationalities. There was, for example, Sanballat the Horonite. So his name isn't Hebrew, it's not Aramaic either. It's a foreign name, probably Persian. And it's maybe difficult to find the derivations of his name, but I suggest it's derived either from Baal, Sanballat, meaning Lord or Master, so probably a Baal worshipper, or there's another word, Lahat, which means magic or sorcery. So you can see the sort of thing that Sanballat the Horonite would be into. Then there's Tobijah the Ammonite. Tobijah is actually a Hebrew name. It's good Hebrew. It means goodness of Yah. So you would think from that he was, you know, an honest Jew. He was an Israelite, etc. But he wasn't. He was an Ammonite. So in Deuteronomy chapter 23 in the law, it says, "An Ammonite or Moabite shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord. Even to their tenth generation shall they not enter into the congregation of the Lord forever." So the Moabites and Ammonites spoke Hebrew. They were sort of brethren, and yet they weren't allowed to enter the temple. And yet, of all things, we find in Nehemiah chapter 13 later that they find the book of the law, and they read that very verse we've just read, and it suddenly dawns on them that an Ammonite, Tobijah, shouldn't be doing all the things he's doing. You know, it's shocking that only just now they find the book of the law. They should have known, even without the law, that there was many warnings against the abomination of the Moabites and the Ammonites. And yet here was Tobijah, an Ammonite, with a good, what you might think of a Hebrew name, leading everyone astray. They should have learned the lesson from Nahash the Ammonite in 1 Samuel 11. Then we find there's Geshem, or Gashmu, it's the same name really, the Arabian. So the Arabs, even back then, were still the Jews' enemy, as they are today. And since we're in Texas, it might seem appropriate to quote from a famous Texan. It was George W. Bush who spoke about an axis of evil against Israel. Well, Nehemiah also had an axis of evil against him with Sanballat and Tobijah and Gashmu. And just as George Bush said that our enemies have misunderestimated us, well, Nehemiah's enemies had also misunderestimated him. And just as George Bush formed a coalition of the willing to stand up against the enemies of Israel, so too Nehemiah also formed a coalition of the willing to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem and defend against the enemies of Israel. Nehemiah was willing to stand against all odds, against all those who would breathe out threatenings and slaughter against him. He was willing to fight the good fight and make sure that God's will, that God's work was done. He knew that if God was for us, who can be against us? But as we read on, we find out more about Tobijah. Tobijah was one of the ones that initially had mocked Nehemiah. Back in Nehemiah chapter 4, Nehemiah the Ammonite was by him, and he said, "Even that which they build, if a fox go up, he shall even break down their stone wall." So he was mocking, even though the wall was made from stone, he was laughing at it as if it was so fragile that a fox going up on it would crumble it down. As we read on in these two chapters, we find that Nehemiah's enemies, his worst enemies, were those of his own household. There was, for example, Noadiah the prophetess, and all the prophets. They were named specifically. In Nehemiah chapter 6 it says, "My God, think thou upon Tobijah and Sanballat, according to these their works, and on the prophetess Noadiah, and the rest of the prophets that would have put me in fear." So even the very prophets, the very God's servants themselves, the people who should have known and who should have been with Nehemiah, even they were against him. We don't know what they did exactly, but they put Nehemiah in fear. So the prophets themselves were against Nehemiah. But things had gotten so bad in that time that even the priests themselves were against him. For example, in Nehemiah chapter 7, as we read, as we're going through those genealogies, we find, first of all, that even some of the people can't even prove that they're even Israelites at all. And the priests, the people who are actually serving God, even they, some of them can't even prove that they even were allowed to be priests. So there was false prophets in Nehemiah's day. There was false priests, people who had no business at all being in the priesthood. They were just there for their own profit, just there for fleecing the people, just as Nehemiah was surrounded by false prophets. Not only were false prophets and false priests the problem, we find also that the corruption was completely endemic in Nehemiah's day. There was lots of nepotism, or sort of giving jobs to your fathers and mothers and uncles and brothers, etc. And also intermarriage was a problem, with people intermarrying and then giving all the good jobs to their family. Everyone was corrupt and feathering their own nest. For example, in Nehemiah chapter 13 we read, "And before this Eliashib the priest," this is a priest of all things, "having the oversight of the chamber of the house of our God, was allied unto Tobijah." So they were allied, Tobijah was allied with the priest. "And Eliashib had prepared for Tobijah a great chamber, where aforetime they laid the meat offerings, the frankincense, and the vessels, and the tithes of the corn, the new wine, and the oil, which was commanded to be given to the Levites, and the singers, and the porters, and the offerings of the priests. And I came to Jerusalem, and understood of the evil that Eliashib did for Tobijah, in preparing him a chamber in the courts of the house of God. And it grieved me sore, therefore I cast out all the household stuff of Tobijah out of the chamber." So the priest, someone who was actually serving in the house of God, but all those stores like the frankincense and vessels and tithes of corn should have been kept, had chucked all that stuff outside and made not just some little compartment, but a great chamber for Tobijah in the actual temple, even though he was an Ammonite, made this great chamber for him to live in. But the nobles themselves were also complicit in this corruption. In Nehemiah chapter 6 we read, "Moreover, in those days the nobles of Judah sent many letters unto Tobijah, and the letters of Tobijah came unto them. For there were many in Judah sworn unto him, because he was the son-in-law of Shechaniah the son of Arah, and his son Jochanan had taken the daughter of Meshullam the son of Benaiah. Also they reported his good deeds before me, and uttered my words to him, and Tobijah sent letters to put me in fear." So the nobles of Judah, those who were leaders, those who should have known better, they understood the evil that Tobijah was doing, and yet they made it all seem as if Tobijah was this, you know, great person, and they wrote nice letters about him, trying to make sure that people didn't speak out against the evil that Tobijah was doing, to make sure they didn't point out that this was an Ammonite actually living in the temple of God. It was just completely outrageous. So the corruption and abuse of positions of power in Nehemiah's day was just absolute. It was from the head, the priests and the prophets themselves, right down all the way through the rulers and nobles, even to the very common people. Like priests, like people, or like prophets, like people. So Nehemiah had to stand up against all of this. He wasn't just building a wall and getting people to do physical building work. He had to stand up against all that corruption. He encountered hostility all around. You know, it takes someone very, very rare to stand up against that level of corruption at that institutional level. It takes someone with honesty, with integrity, with guts, with true grit, determination, and someone who's not afraid of their life. Well, Nehemiah was such a person as that. In American history, you have a few people who did stand up to corruption at that level. There's people, for example, like Eliot Ness, who had the bravery and integrity to stand up against Al Capone and take him down. Or there was people like Frank Serpico of the New York Police Department, who risked his life to stand up against corruption in the NYPD. So Nehemiah was a bit like the Eliot Ness of his day, someone who was standing up to people like Al Capone, just gangsters who just wanted to take over and who didn't care about the outrage of taking over the temple and living in it. But I've got a question for you. In Nehemiah's day, we've seen just how bad things had got. You know, the prophets and priests were corrupt, ordinary people were corrupt. At what stage should someone have said something? At what stage should someone have said, look, you know, we can't do this anymore, this is crazy, there's an Ammonite serving in the Lord, in the temple? Should you have waited until a prophet said something, or maybe one of the priests? Should you, as an individual, have said something? Did people think there was maybe some red line where, you know, if someone finally crossed the red line, you know, then they would say something? Were people waiting for other people to kind of say, well, I'll say something if you will? Well, let me tell you a parable, a story, or an allegory. This is a story about how error spreads. So once upon a time, there were four brethren: everybody, somebody, anybody, and nobody. Apostasy had crept into the brotherhood. Everybody knew it. And so everybody was asked out, was asked to purge out the leaven before it leavened the whole lump. But everybody was sure somebody would deal with the problem. Anybody could have tried to resolve the issues, but nobody did it. Somebody got angry when people said he should do something, because he thought it was everybody's job. Everybody knew anybody could do it, and everybody knew that somebody should do it, but nobody realised that everybody wouldn't do it. So it ended up that everybody blamed somebody for not dealing with the apostasy, when nobody asked anybody to deal with it, and nobody did anything. And yet everybody could and should have done it. So that was a lesson, if you like, the parable. You know, everybody can see there's problems, and when everybody can see there's problems, everybody should deal with it. You know, every one of us needs to be a Nehemiah and stand up for what's right. Sometimes the problems might be too big for anybody to deal with, you know, any one individual. But somebody has to make sure that problems like were in Nehemiah's day don't happen, and the error just doesn't continue. So in practice, everybody needs to look out for error. You know, we're all responsible, we're all in fellowship together. And Nehemiah understood that everybody should help to build the wall and to purge out all this leaven that had crept in. So those are the sort of main thoughts I had. I'd like to sort of finish off by just looking at some examples of Nehemiah as a type of Christ. And I've got 12 ways in which Nehemiah is a type of Christ. You know, 12 is a good biblical number. So one, Nehemiah was doing God's work, God's will, and God was with him, just as God was with Christ. Nehemiah was building the walls and the temple, just as Christ will build the temple of Ezekiel. The people of the land were generally with him, but it was the prophets and priests, the leaders, that were conspiring against him. You know, the ruling authorities sought to take Nehemiah's life through subtlety and deceit, just as the leaders later on in Christ's day would do the same. Nehemiah didn't fear, even though he knew his life was in danger and they wanted to kill him, just as Christ later wouldn't be in fear. They sought Nehemiah's life because their own deeds were evil, and he brought their evil deeds to light. They couldn't argue against him, in terms of Scripture, just as they couldn't argue against Christ in terms of Scripture. They could find no fault in Nehemiah, try as they might, and that's the same with Christ. They eventually had to use, you know, false witnesses with lying words to try to make something up against Nehemiah, just invent lies to try to capture him, just as they did with Christ. And rather than kill him themselves, for fear of the people, they used legal means and used the power of the ruling authorities to get or try to get Nehemiah killed, just as the rulers in Christ's day wouldn't kill him themselves and didn't want to take him at the feast. But they tried to use legal means, the Roman authorities, to get Christ killed. Nehemiah was betrayed by Shemaiah, who was hired with money to try to trick him, just as Judas later would be hired with money to try to capture Christ. And also the name Nehemiah means comforted of Yah. It reminds us of the place Capernaum, where Christ preached. Capernaum is the same Nahum, part of Nehemiah. It means village of comfort. So there's the very name Nehemiah reminds us of the place where Christ preached in Capernaum. So just a few points for discussion, possible points for discussion before I sit down. First of all, people might have a few other types of Christ that they can think of with Nehemiah. But also a question again. Nehemiah continued in the work that he did. He was just determined to do God's will, despite all the problems or opposition which he faced. So when we go down a certain path, we might often get opposition or problems or things cropping up. So how do we know when our Father isn't just trying to tell us, you know, don't go down that path because you're starting to meet opposition, etc.? How do we know when going down a certain path is against God's will? You might think, well, if you get opposition after opposition after opposition, maybe that's God telling you that don't go down that path. And yet in Nehemiah's day, he just went down that path anyway because he knew that that was the right path to do. So if we get opposition, to what extent do we think that's just something we should, you know, plough through and work through? Or when do we know that that's maybe God telling us that, you know, this isn't a good path to go down? So there, hopefully that will raise a few discussion points.